Good morning. My name is Cecil Prescott, and you are listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO FM. If you are listening in Portland, that's 90.7, in Hood River, 91.9, and in Corvallis, 100.7. You may also listen to us via the web, KBOO FM. Today is Monday, August 29th, 2011. We welcome you and thank you for joining us this morning. Portland has had a troubled history in regards to the relationships between the Portland Police Bureau and several segments of this community. Today we will have a conversation with Tyrone Waters, who will share his thoughts and ideas about this troubled history. Historically, Portland has had a troubled history in terms of its interaction with the African-American community and also with other communities, minority communities. And in several ways, we continue to struggle with how to improve the situation. We invite you to listen in on our conversation this morning and be a part of our conversation as we seek solutions. Joining us this morning is Tyrone Waters. He's a native Portlander, born and raised in Portland. He comes from a family of activists. He has written a couple of books. His first book was entitled, You Will Be Paranoid Too If It Happened to You. And he has recently authored a zine called Solutions. Tyrone is a certified life coach, and we thank you for joining us this morning, Tyrone. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning. I've been anxious to have you on the program for some time. Perhaps as a way of introduction, if you could tell us a little bit about you. I mentioned that you come from a family of activists, and we've had one person in your family on this program that people might know. Tell us something about your background.
Okay. Excuse me. I'm the son of former Oregon State Senator Avell Gordley, and I am a certified holistic life coach. I attended the University of Metaphysics Holistic Life Coach Institute, where I got my credentials. I also have attended a culinary program, Le Cordon Bleu, program. And presently, I am on the board of directors at Disability Rights Oregon, where we do advocacy and case litigation for inmates and patients that are locked up in mental health facilities. And I have also spoken out at police rallies in the city of Portland, protesting the misconduct and mistreatment of citizens by the Portland police. I'm very proud of my mom as an activist and a former legislator as well for her work that she's done in the legislature to get laws passed regarding some of these situations.
Great. And speaking of about that, in terms of your background, share a little bit of your experience about growing up in Portland. I know Portland has changed over the years, and think of, just tell us something about your growing up experience. What was it like then in terms of the relationship among communities, the African-American community and the general population at large, and have you noticed changes over the years?
My experience has been growing up and living in the city of Portland. It's a very racist, subtle city. People like to think that the city of Portland is progressive and doing all these wonderful things, but my experience has been that it's very racist, very subtle. Those are the types of overtones that I've experienced. Also being called the N-word by a student when going through grade school at Irvington Elementary Grade School. And so it's been challenging growing up and just being African American, a black male in the city of Portland.
Now, I mentioned that you come from a family of activists who've been very involved in the community over several generations, as it were. As you were growing up and as you sat around, I don't know, the dining room table, did the elders talk about their experiences and share it with you?
Yes, they did. I remember my grandfather, who was a Pullman porter on the railroad for Union Pacific Railroad, talking about the racism that he had to deal with on the railroad as a Pullman porter in the passenger car of the train. And he would tell me that the Caucasian or white passengers would call him boy or the N-word. They were very disrespectful and treated him less than a second-class citizen.
And so that was something he shared with you and your with your grandfather. And then growing up, your mother with your mother and the other relatives. Now, your mother was very involved, I imagine, when you were young, in terms of political involvement in the activities.
Right.
Did she, like, carry you around to meetings and stuff like that?
She did, actually. My mom was very active in the Black United Front. She also did some work with American Friends Service Committee. But I remember her being most active with the Black United Front. And they were dealing with issues surrounding mistreatment of citizens by the police. Also, they were dealing with issues around education and improving the education infrastructure with the Portland Public Schools. So there were a number of issues that they would address in the community. I remember them addressing a lot of police issues. There was a lot of just mistreatment and misconduct going on by the Bureau.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. We're speaking this morning with Tyrone Waters, an activist in the community, about police accountability and police responsibility. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We'll ask you to join and be a part of this conversation in a few moments. Tyrone, you shared in terms of your mother and her involvement with the Black United Front and addressing the issues around police accountability. For many of us, this might be an academic issue. As someone who knew about the troubles with the police growing up, were there any lessons shared with you growing up in terms of how you should interact with the police? I want to talk a little bit later about your experience, personal experience, but when you were growing up, what type of lessons were told to you?
Basically, my mom wanted me to be aware of how dangerous things could become with a negative interaction with them. She was very strict when I was growing up. She made sure that I was in by curfew. There were a few times when I came home after curfew and I was not allowed to go out the next day. So she was very strict about me coming in and being home by curfew. And she explained to me that if I did not come home, you know, by the end of curfew, that I could be picked up and arrested and taken to JDH if, you know, if I were stopped by the police. So that was the, pretty much the way that she explained that to me.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that in different communities, how parents raise their children, particularly in terms of how you should respond to the police. I'm always struck by, depending on the community, whether you grew up in say, white suburbia or inner city, the lessons that are taught about how you should interact with the police are different. So I think it's important to share that, you know, as you were growing up, what type of lessons you were taught. Now, you have written a couple of books, and the first book is entitled, I love the title, You Would Be Paranoid Too If It Happened to You. In that book, you talk about yourself, about your life, and you've been very open about your disability. Could you share something about... well, let's begin by sharing about negative interaction with the police in terms of your diagnosis and how those things involved develop.
Okay. First of all, I'm someone that has a mental illness. I have paranoid schizophrenia, which I take medication for. And it works very well, and I have been free from any type of episodes for the past 10 years. What I would like to be able to say is that... my experience with the police was, it's kind of, I'm just a little upset because I have to relive it. But I came home in 2001 to my grandfather's residence one day after working. And I had a backpack, and I went over to the next door neighbor's house onto her porch, and we were talking and having a conversation. And then I noticed that an unmarked police car had pulled up in front of the house. And so I grabbed my backpack and I walked down my neighbor's steps to the sidewalk, and the police noticed that there was a pellet gun in my backpack. And there were two officers that had responded to the location where I was at. One of them was Derek Foxworth. And there was another officer, and I don't recall what his name was. As you know, Derek Foxworth at one point in time was the chief of police. Mm-hmm. And he's retired now and no longer on the police bureau. Drew out their weapons and pointed them at me and told me to drop the gun. And I froze at first and just was rigid and afraid and didn't move. And I yelled out, "I don't want to hurt anybody." And they kept saying, "Drop the gun, drop the gun." But I was afraid that if I dropped the gun or flinched or, you know, dropped the backpack or flinched or moved, that they would kill me. And then shortly after that, it was just a matter of seconds. 20 to 30 more officers arrived on the scene with their guns pointed at me. And Derek Foxworth had told the officers not to fire live rounds and told them to fire beanbag rounds at me to get me to drop the backpack and the pellet gun. There was an officer that fired live rounds of ammunition at me, and by the grace of God, I'm still here alive because those live rounds missed me, and I was struck by the beanbag rounds and injured.
Did Officer Foxworth recognize who you were, or did people know who you were?
I believe that he did know who I was because I later found out that he had had a conversation with a family member prior to coming out to the residence.
Mm-hmm. So just one other thing, just to clarify, at that point, had you been diagnosed before or was it subsequent to that incident?
No, I had been diagnosed prior to that.
Prior to that, okay. Mm-hmm. So just by the grace of God, you were not one of those fatalities or statistics.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here this morning with Tyrone Waters, a community activist, and we invite your conversation as we talk about the police and the community and how we might make changes to ensure a safe community for all citizens. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. It's really hard for me, and I imagine many of us, to imagine what that might have done to you as a person in terms of response. You might want to share a little bit more about what happened afterwards, but I'm wanting to know that particularly in terms of how that might have pushed you in terms of being more concerned about finding solutions in the community.
Mm-hmm. Let me start out first by saying what happened after I was shot. All of my clothes were stripped off of me by the police and paramedics. So I was lying on the ground naked in plain view of everyone in the neighborhood to see. They put me on a gurney and took me to the emergency room at Emmanuel Hospital, and that was where my mom had shown up. They had me in a locked room, tied down to the bed in 4-point restraints. Then they wrapped my wrist up so that my mom could not see my injuries from the beanbag rounds. Then I stayed overnight at Emmanuel, locked in a room with a police officer outside of the room. My mom left sometime that evening and said that she would see me later. The next day, a police officer came and told me that he was taking me to the Justice Center. He did not read me my Miranda rights and took me to the Justice Center. I was booked into the Multnomah County Justice Center jail. Once there, my attorney tried to come and see me and see how I was doing and trying to get me ready for court because the police had overcharged me with attempted aggravated murder and attempted aggravated assault. All for having a pellet gun, which wasn't even pointed at them. I was not allowed to see my attorney. The Multnomah County corrections officers would not allow me to see my attorney when he came to visit. And they told him that I didn't want to visit or see him, which was a blatant lie. And then I was carted off to the Oregon State Hospital where I was sent for an evaluation. And while at the Oregon State Hospital, I was sexually assaulted by another patient there that was sent over from the Department of Corrections prison system to be treated. I was physically assaulted by a registered nurse staff at the hospital, at the Oregon State Hospital. I was placed on a special diet, and my meals would come from the kitchen ice cold, and they would refuse to heat them up for me and serve them at the correct temperature. They would throw my medication on the floor and tell me to pick it up and take it. There were a lot of abusive things that I witnessed that I saw that were horrific. And they have a sign outside of the hospital that says people helping people, but I don't see how I was helped. If anything, I was traumatized by it, and I have emotional scarring from it. My mother and I tried to sue the city of Portland and the state of Oregon, and we were told that basically that if I prevailed in the lawsuit, that they would go after my disability benefits so that I would not be able to prevail and live my life. They've been, both the city of Portland and the state of Oregon have been very hostile towards me, as well as certain citizens in the city of Portland. It's just been a real difficult thing to get through.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult, and I thank you just for sharing and being a part of this conversation. I think it's so important for people to realize that the impact and the life experiences of people, because it's not merely an academic discussion. It's very personal and existential. From this experience and from experiences you've had, you've been able to create and be encouraged to be a part of a movement to transform our society and our community. I wanted to talk some more about that, how you took such a horrific experience and how you've been able to transform it into the life of an activist. I think we have one caller online, so let's go to Jayla, and then good morning, Jayla. Are you there? Jayla, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. The person on your show reminded me of an incident that happened to me last week when I was coming home from work. And you know how the they're state patrol officers who point the speed gun at you? You know, the speed, the thing that take how fast you're going? Hello?
Yes, hello. We're just having problems with our headphones. So continue, please.
Okay. So one of the state patrol officers were pointing a speed gun at me. I was driving in my car. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Yes, we can.
Okay. All right. And so anyway, he was standing on the side of the street near the yellow line, real close to the yellow line, and he was pointing the speed gun at me, and I thought he was about to shoot me. And I thought he was about to shoot me right then, because it's so many shootings in Portland that happen that are not based on anything or any logical reason. I was so frightened, I almost slowed down to 35 miles an hour.
Mm.
And that was based on just knowing that you can be shot for any reason, and then a reason can be justified.
I can create a reason, yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your story is not an isolated one, Jayla. Tyrone, do you have some... Tyrone has written in terms of his book Solutions about what to do when you're stopped by the police, and we'll share some of those. So thank you, Jayla.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to More Talk Radio. All numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Tyrone Waters, who is a community activist, engaged in creating a more friendly, user-friendly police here in our town. Let's go to Karen. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been listening to the show, and really a great idea. It's certainly needed, especially with the current atmosphere where we see rather a militarization of our police force, and that being pretty much across the board, it doesn't matter who you are. Of course, there's different segments of the population that are going to be regarded differently. I happen to be someone also who has a mental disability, and I get a different reaction from the police myself. Guns drawn and stuff like that. I have seen some of the worst of the police. Basically, when I spoke to my son, I have a teenager who's on his own journey, but I basically instructed him, these are human beings. And the discretion of the officer in the moment is everything.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to any kind of compliance, anything can happen. I mean, it's interesting that the idea that you should have to be in some environment to, or that there's a place, white suburbia, where you don't regard the police as a threatening force. I don't know of that place.
Mm. Okay. No, I suppose that may be correct. Yeah. And thank you. And when you shared with your son, have you made him aware of being cautious or in terms of how he should respond?
Well, basically, my instruction to him was that these are first human beings,
mm-hmm.
and they will shoot you. I mean, my experience was, being young and drunk and stupid, I insulted him and... Mm. In every way that I could, they pulled the car over and took me out. And I'm like, why are they searching me on the side of the road? And they just beat the tar out of me, handcuffed, put me back in the car and took me to jail. But I mean, that it really impressed me that these aren't always professionals.
Mm-hmm.
These are most often individuals, and they're going to act and react like human beings. And that the discretion of the officer in the moment, nobody's going to come to your defense against the police, regardless of what they do. And to know that ahead of time, I mean, I just told him it's yes sir, no sir, and simply comply.
Right.
there's nothing else you can do. And I've heard horror stories beyond description, really, especially on the radio. But, I mean, my experience has been also that there are some, especially, I mean, most people have no idea what it is to be discredited as someone, you know, with a mental disability. You're automatically discredited. Mm-hmm. And to basically be India has untouchables. Mm. The United States has people with mental disability. You can be killed without cause. I mean, we've seen that in Portland too often. So, I think the general militarization of our police force and, you know, being plied with federal money, certainly, it's an uphill battle. But community awareness is everything in that battle. At least, you know, from my perspective. It's interesting, the idea that it should be that the idea that I'm more at risk if I'm Hispanic or Black or anything. I don't know that that's necessarily true. Of course, I can only speak from my own experience. But certainly, if I have to deal with the police, I'm very well aware. I don't go into it with the idea I got rights and they can't do that. Mm-hmm. I've seen otherwise. And just exactly like you say, if it happens to you, you know, what do they say? What you get when you don't get what you want? Experience. I've had the experience to be informed that, yeah, it is, regardless of who you are, any encounter with the police is potentially deadly. Certainly. And that is a world different from, you know, 30 years ago. Even the idea of serve and protect, how many people even entertain that concept? Mm-hmm. It's certainly, I don't know, few in Portland.
Certainly. Hey, but thank you for sharing. I'm going to let Tyrone respond. Thank you for calling. Share something, and Tyrone, you on the board on the, what's the name of the organization?
It's called Disability Rights Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I advocate for individuals with mental illness, with patients from the Oregon State Hospital, as well as in the state prison system and the county jails. I have regular communication and dialogue with individuals from those institutions and help to advocate for them.
And recently you've had a more positive encounters with the police.
Share right. In March 2011, I met with the Portland police for 2 hours about my experience with them. They invited me to come back and facilitate a training for officers of the Bureau dealing with mental health issues, helping to break down barriers and removing the stigma.
Yes. Well, that's great, because I think, as our previous caller mentioned, just in terms of the stigma, that's something that people carry. So I applaud you for your work. We have a couple of more callers, so let's go to Joanne. Good morning, Joanne.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, okay. I have a hearing problem. That's why I'm asked. Yes, sir. I'm very glad for this program, even though it breaks my heart. Excuse me, I'll try to get composed. One of the many things that has bothered me, issues in this country, there's so many. Like one of them, I don't know whether you have any opinions or think about, is this, the rape that goes on in prisons, has been going on in prisons for generations they don't do anything about. And the rapes that go on in the military that they don't seem to do anything about. And also one more thing, and I'll go. This thing they're paying attention to now, international sex trafficking, and Portland is supposed to be involved. Anyway, I'll get off the air, and thank you for the program, and goodbye.
Thank you, Joanne, for sharing. We'll go to our next caller. Michael, good morning.
Hey, Cecil, how are you doing?
I'm well.
So, now, let me bring some reality in this show. You know, what really pisses me off is that the reason that police brutality still exists because you have certain segments of the white population that don't believe that the police target people of color. They target people in certain economic categories and mental illness. And so also, you know, there's certain segment of the white population that don't even believe racism exists. And you know and I know that America is a racist society. What you see on a grand scale where this country is constantly bombing people of color, they're not out bombing European nations. They bomb people of color. Well, then when you break it down in a community level, you got the police out here targeting people of color. It's just like that policeman that shot that dog. Isn't it ironic that nobody in the community has ever felt threatened by that dog, but yet all of a sudden here come a white policeman, and he's unique in that he feels threatened by a dog, and he shoots the dog. And another thing, too, why is it in Portland that most of the shootings that is done by white males? There's females on the force. There's African-Americans on the force. There might even be there's Asians and Hispanic. Why is it that whenever there's a shooting done, it's done by a white male? Now, think about that.
And that's a good observation, Michael. Thanks for sharing that.
All right.
Great. Tyrone? Yep.
Yeah, I would just like to say I agree with Michael because the day that I was shot at, the officer that fired the live rounds was Caucasian. He was a white male that would not follow the instructions that Derek Foxworth gave to use less lethal rounds and to use beanbag rounds. I also wanted to just quickly say that I agree with Michael about the racism. I've experienced racism in my housing. I live in a REACH community development housing where I've been discriminated against. My life has been threatened by my neighbors. I've had my food tampered with in my apartment. I've had my vehicles tampered with as well. So the harassment continues.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Coming up this morning at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour. This program looks at what cities like Portland must do to deal with climate change and how corporations influence what is taught in school. The case of coal and the Chamber of Commerce and a review of the new movie, The Help. At 10 is Chris Andre, host Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, the guest is Stephen Thompson, an American living in Japan who is working on issues around the radiation coming from the Fukushima plant. At 11 on the radio zine, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher interviews Abby Rappaport, a reporter with the Texas Observer, about the presidential candidacy of Rick Perry, his campaign strategy, and his record in Texas. She also speaks with political science professor Thomas Ferguson about how Congress is listening primarily to those who contribute political money and not the public. At 11:30, Thay Meyer interviews local activist Sharon Gary Smith, who is the new director of the McKenzie River Gathering Foundation. We want to thank all KBOO members for your support. And if you are not a member of KBOO, you can become one by going to KBOO-FM and clicking on the tip jar. This morning, you're listening to More Talk Radio. I'm speaking with Tyrone Waters, a local community activist and the author of two books, You Will Be Paranoid Too, If It Happened to You, and Solutions. We'll go more about your books in a moment, but we have a couple of callers online, so let's go to John Doe. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I just need a few minutes to break this down, okay, because what we're dealing with is this last guy that was on the phone, the guy that's talking about racism. He is right. But it isn't just the white people. It's the blacks. It's the Mexicans. It's everybody's racist. And it isn't because they want to be racist. They're not being pulled out of the womb racist. They're not being pulled out of the womb hating. What it is hate and racism is bred through the media. And then we go back down into the capitalism society where the people are being forced to go work 5 jobs to pay for these 1% of the millionaires and billionaires in the world to wreak havoc over the colored people in the world. Now, they might be doing some bombing in Iraq and Iran and all this stuff on the ground, but they're waging war against every single race on the planet through the food that they put out, through the media that they put out. The media is wreaking racism. It is rampant. And when you're in capitalism society and you're forced to put your children in front of a babysitter like a television because you can't afford it, then you will have a racist black boy or girl. You will have a racist white person. You will have a racist Indian. It is in the programming to be sociopathic. And when you have the military coming home from the war with no counseling, full of depleted uranium, dying, and they don't even know they're dying, and they're sick, and you put them on the streets with no counseling, they are going to kill people. They are going to rape their conscience from their bodies. So what we have to do as a black society, as a Muslim society, as a white society, is turn the freaking television off, take responsibility for your own children, raise them properly with some education of your own self, and keep them away from other people that are racist. But until we deal with the military that's coming home from these wars that are fighting for the billionaires, we will have retarded people. We will have developmentally disabled people. We will have local people that are kind. We will have children being beaten and their conscience being raped by these people. And until we take responsibility for ourselves and get away from the money and the TV, we will not change nothing. So blessings to the people that are suffering from this. And I give thanks and praises every day for the blessings of God and Spirit. Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing and the call, the challenge for us to make changes in our society. And another point we could talk about, because you're a veteran, aren't you?
Yeah, yes.
And another point. But let's go to another caller right now. Rob, good morning.
Morning, and thanks for letting me on. This is me. Is this you?
I am here.
So anyway, I agree with the gentleman before. John Doe was a nice intro into what I have to say. And an interest of the writer, too, that something for him to check out as well. The previous caller was concerned about institutional racism, and this country is the largest purveyor of institutional racism, and that's absolutely correct. And you always have to see who benefits from racism, and that's the person or the entity that will be stirring up racism the most. And we all know that our government benefits the most from racism, and we all know that the rich people benefit the most from racism, because if they keep us fighting amongst ourselves and stirred up as divide and conquer, then we'll never actually get to the a-holes who are creating this whole situation for their benefit. But back to mental illness and mental health. Here's an interesting part for him. And check into how many police officers and correction officers and people like that who are on disability from mental issues. A lot of people don't realize the situation breeds poor mental health. Mm. They have programs for it called employee assistant programs, EAP. I myself am in my second year of Social Security, 14 years of working in corrections. You can't imagine the amount of racism. If you want to go see racism bred, go to a prison or a jail anywhere, and you can see the stew of racism that is boiling everywhere, which is created by whom? Again, tax-paying people with the government stealing it from them and creating these
most vile racist situations you could think of. And so I myself was diagnosed with schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia, and I wore a uniform, and I walked around, and I worked in the hole. And see, and that type of work, also, those people can be successful at that type of work. They can be rewarded and paid for that kind of work. And I myself have a letter from Governor Neil Goldschmidt for doing that kind of work, and I have multiple personalities. Mm-hmm. I had to compartmentalize to be able to go and do that work. No human can do that kind of work. Mm-hmm. And corrections affect and police affect everybody.
Yes.
So look at the high rate of police officers and corrections officers and military people who are getting Social Security from being mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've got mentally ill people running around with that discretion that he's writing about. The last, the previous caller before that, where you can pull a person out and beat them senseless,
right.
And you're going to be defended. Well, you have the gun, you have the power of life and death, and you're a paranoid schizophrenic.
Certainly.
Can you imagine that?
That's a great point you made in terms of. In terms of the police officers and Corrections Institute. Thank you for calling. Thank you for sharing. Tyrone, do you want to share?
Would just like to say that some of us were silenced by the legal system and the police. And I'm here to say no stigma against the homeless, no racism, no homophobia, no justice, and no peace. I also want people to know that my mother and I, Avell Gordley, we met with the U.S. Department of Justice officials recently, just a few weeks ago, and we shared with them my story. They said they were going to continue their investigation, and they also talked to us about other incidents that had occurred with the police, and I asked them to help facilitate and bring about a settlement with the city of Portland and the state of Oregon. And the other thing that I said to them is that I do not believe in civil rights in this day and age. And the reason being is because you have to be dead and buried in order to have your civil rights. And what good does it do if you're 6 feet in the ground and dead and gone?
Wow. Powerful words. You are right, and we mentioned on the two volumes you've written. Tell us briefly in terms of what motivated you to write it and how describe the two books briefly and where people may obtain copies.
Okay. Presently, the book You Would Be Paranoid Too If This Happened to You is sold out. It was for sale at Powell's Books and also at Reflections Talking Drum Bookstore and Coffee Shop on North Killingsworth. The book Solutions is available at Reflections on North Killingsworth, and it's also available downtown at Powell's Books in the zine section at that location on Burnside. I wrote the first book just to get it out there to remove the stigma about mental illness and to let people know that people with mental illness are people too, and all mental illness is a chemical imbalance in the brain, and it can be treated with medication just like diabetes or high blood pressure or some of the other ailments that people suffer from. It can be treated with medication, and you can live a normal and productive life. I also wanted people to know that the reason why mentally ill people do not take their medication is because of the side effects. Some of the side effects are so horrific that it far outweighs the benefit of the medication. There was a medication that I was on called Prolixin, and it caused severe muscle pain in my body when I was on it. And on a scale of 1 to 10, it felt like a 20 as regard to the pain. So you can easily see how that would make a person not want to take the medication. Also, some of the medications cause weight gain and can cause diabetes in African Americans. There's also other health issues that people have concerns about with regard to the side effects of the medication. Mm-hmm. So don't just say, oh, you know, go away, take your medication and, you know, sweep it under the carpet. We have to deal with the fact that there are side effects to the medication, and that's why people do not want to take their medication. That's why they go off of their medication, and that is the reason why they wind up in situations where there's encounters with the police.
I really appreciate you taking the time to come and speak with us today, Tyrone, and this is, you know, only been 50 minutes. We can extend it probably for a couple of hours at least. We have a couple of minutes, and I think we have a couple of callers online, so we'll try to get to them. Good morning, Anna.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, and I just wanted to say amen to the callers and amen to your guests. I mean, what a horrific story. And, you know, the truth is about, yes, racism is just permeates our world. And as far as mental health issues, I think each and every one of us have something. It's a matter of degree.
Mm-hmm.
And something to think about. We need some serious medication for this may be off the wall, but it seems to me that so oftentimes people seeking power and in power positions probably could be very well diagnosed and should be diagnosed with sociopathic tendencies and psychopathic tendencies.
I think you make a very good point there. Hey, we're running close to the
end. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. And real briefly, let's get to the next caller. We only have about 30 seconds, Marianne.
Oh, gosh, and I have about 2 or 3 minutes.
Oh.
I just want to reiterate what the previous caller said, but I want to go reiterate, and remind everybody you do not have to be mentally ill to be assaulted, to be horrifically treated by the police in this city. And it wasn't like this 30 years ago. It goes way beyond being mentally challenged or mentally different. It's anybody who isn't rich or privileged. I am white, but I am a woman living in North Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to remind people that, thank gosh, that isn't African-American cops or Asian or women cops that have, because that, of course, will be a new low. And furthermore, the women cops are the ones that have treated me the worst.
Oh, okay.
So 30 seconds. Thank you
for
bringing this up and out in the light. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Marianne. Thank you, Tyrone, for joining us and sharing your story.
Sure.
And we'll look for your book. And are you writing anything more?
I'll give it some thought, maybe over the next year or so.
You've been listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. Thank you and have a great day.